spirit of reconciliation, I acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. I pay my respects to the elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island peoples today. Welcome to Totally Lit, the podcast celebrating reading, writing and creating literature. I'm your host, Kai Garvey. Thank you for listening. This episode, I chat to author-illustrator Lucy Hawkins. Lucy is a writer and artist who lives in Australia's Yarra Valley with her husband and two young daughters. She studied journalism at the University of the Arts in London and worked at Cosmopolitan magazine and the London paper in the UK, as well as newspapers and magazines around the world. Her original artwork, prints and homewares, are sold in stores across Australia, and her first children's book, The Salvager's Quest, is available online and in all good bookstores now. I hope you enjoy our chat. Lucy Hawkins, welcome to Totally Lit. Thank you for joining me.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
I'm really excited to hear about your book release, The Salvager's Quest. Can you tell me a bit about your book?
I can. It's a middle grade fiction and it's about two sisters from Healesville in Victoria and how they magically go to this other planet, which is very much like Earth, but it's run by children. And there are some what we would have considered extinct animals living there, like woolly mammoths, etc. And the girls are entrusted with rescuing endangered animals on Earth and taking them to this planet, Planet Beatrice, where they will be safe and prosper. So Planet Beatrice, Plan B, it's like an alternative to Earth. But run by kids with sort of animals welfare at the forefront.
And what age group would be the right fit for your book?
Well, it was intended for 9 to 12, but my 6.5-year-old has read the first and the second, and she loved it. So it depends, I suppose, on the child, but roughly 9 to 12. The heroines are, I think, about 9 to 12 in the first one, and it's the first of a series, and they steadily progress upwards, and I'm actually writing the third one, which is a so we've suddenly got into slightly darker waters, but for the time being you should be fine with a 6+, I'd say, but 9 to 12.
And can you tell me a bit about your inspiration to write the book?
Absolutely. Well, I was I've always been interested in environmental causes and animal welfare. And when I was pregnant with my second daughter and I was doing bushwalks here in Victoria, and then it was the terrible bushfires of 2019, 2020, and just seeing the utter devastation of the bush, and I think something like 3 billion animals perished. And obviously, of course, this was also in the run-up to COVID. And being heavily pregnant, I was wondering what kind of world I was bringing my child into. I already had my first daughter. And it was a time of anxiety for literally everyone on the planet. And I just thought, if we could just do things differently, how would that be? How would it work? How could we improve? So that was the origins of it, really.
Well, I know yesterday I got a series of texts from my son concerned about the planet, which was just a bit random. Well, he's 21, but he has Asperger's. And he let, thank you, I'll take that. My two boys, I've got a 21-year-old and an about to be 18-year-old. And just randomly yesterday, he said, oh, there is 200 years left until trees go extinct due to humans cutting them down. Now there are 3 trillion trees. It's estimated by 2050 there will be 2.5 trillion trees. And I kind of responded with, well, we can plant a tree in the backyard if that will help, which is a bit flippant, but also the problems seem too big sometimes, and I was like, what can I do at my level to help? So I'm like, I can plant a tree, what else can we do? But I think it is, those issues are on our children's mind as well.
They are. I took my daughter to the climate march a few months ago in Melbourne, and it was so powerful to see all these young people really rally together, and you could see how comforted they were to see other kids just like them worrying about the same thing, because otherwise it's really isolating. It's like, what's going on here? And it's all so out of our control, and the governments are making these decisions based on getting voted in the near future, with seemingly no consideration for the future and for these guys' future. And I wrote an article recently about teen anxiety over the environment, and it's absolutely a thing, and it makes sense, doesn't it? If you think we're all doomed, then what's the point? That's a really real terrifying concern.
And have you had feedback from young readers on the themes in your book? What sort of response have you had?
I've had really positive feedback, and I'm not sure if this is standard, a national philosophy for teaching young. Like, mine are very young. So mine's youngest is at kinder, and my eldest is grade one primary. But both of their schooling institutions very much teach how to look after the planet, sort of beginning in your backyard. So it's a real tangible approach. So it's let's compost, let's recycle. They have chickens at their kinder, and they have a surplus of eggs that they give to the community. And it's just everything comes back to grassroots. And so they are being raised to feel that it is in their control, which I think is key, because as soon as you think it's got nothing to do with me, nothing I can do is going to make an impact, then you just give up on it. So I think they've got the right philosophy, certainly in my town, and hopefully nation and worldwide, about teaching kids that, yeah, it's important to recycle because there aren't endless amount of trees, and if we could just keep chopping them down to a minimum, that would be a good thing. So yeah, but I think by suggesting we can plant a tree for your son, that's a really good, tangible, let's make a difference. Unfortunately, we don't really have the power to make the big decisions unless we go
No.
on climate marches. So it is down to us to do the little things, which do all add up if all the kids are doing them.
And 'cause you are residing in regional Victoria, so the threat of bushfires as well is like an immediate issue as well in terms of living in those areas. Have you found any impact of your book with children that are living in those areas where bushfires are a fact of life?
Yes, definitely. I mean, our town has signs everywhere saying this is the meeting point. If there's a bushfire, we all have a plan. We're all told, as you drive into the town, there's a scale of the likelihood of a bushfire today. And if it goes into the oranges or the reds, then you're on high alert. So yeah, it's a reality, definitely. But I'm sure that there are very few places on the planet that are untouched by global warming at the moment, whether it's if you live at near a river and it's flooding. I think pretty much everywhere you go, there's going to be some change happening. And of course, climate change has the climate has always changed. It's just that it's more rapid now than ever before, and because humans are burning fossil fuels. So sorry if I've gone off piste a little bit there, but yes, it's very real to the kids here, and I think it probably is all over the world, isn't it? That it's something to consider.
Well, I think too, it sounds like there's themes in your book that are global and about the future, but there's also those things in your own town that are immediate problems as well. So, you can be, a bushfire can be coming through tomorrow, whereas global warming is something we need to be working on for the future. So, you've got some great themes in there to provoke thought as well, I think.
Thank you. And I think with each book, the theme, the location on Earth will change. So they'll be rescuing a different endangered animal all over the world. with each location facing its own problems.
Ah, fantastic. So you'll be broadening.
Yes, but it felt important to, and it felt crucial to start here where we are. And it was, I didn't know whether it would get published or not, so it was really written to my daughters, and so this is their reality. The potential of bushfires is their current reality.
I think too, you can have that element of authenticity in your work as well if you're just writing to what you want to write rather than trying to write to market or for a trend. How have you found your experience at the, because this is your first release, what has the experience been like as a debut author?
Initially it was very exciting to get a deal, and then it was a very long process, I'd say over a year, and which I wasn't really aware of, and it didn't seem like anyone else in my world was aware of. So everyone kept saying, "Oh, when's it coming out? When's it coming out?" And then by the time that it did come out, I really had to reread it because I couldn't quite remember what was in it. And by then I'd already written the second. And so, so a long process, but I think that's pretty standard. And I'm a really impulsive person. So it has taught me, or is currently teaching me, patience. But what's good is to focus on each day of it. I just love the writing. And so it just sort of, it unfolds as and when it unfolds.
And have you been like engaging with local schools and libraries and getting out and about?
I've got an event at our local library in March, the start of March, and all primary schools in the area are going to come along, and
Oh, fantastic.
the local MP, who is very keen to talk about all things environmental. I think the local paper might come down, so that's exciting. I think that the response locally has been great. I've been to a few different schools and read sections of it out, and the kids are just amazed that the heroes are from Healesville, that or that they're kids like them, that they're not from the city, or they're not from a different country. They're actually just like them, which they'd never read anything like that before. So that was a nice trip.
Oh, that's great. It's really good for kids to see themselves in books. And that can sometimes be challenging too when we are the writers, like, because we tend to mirror ourselves in our work. And it can be challenging to be inclusive and diversive and, yeah, just trying to paint a picture of real kids in the real world. Fantastic. So, you are also a artist. Tell me about your work. I think that I've checked out all your website and had a look at some of your aprons and bags that, I'm in love with the canvas totes. But most of them are sold
Yeah, they
out.
are. They went really quickly. I will have to do a second line. Yeah, thank you. That was the first. So we moved to the country from the city when I was pregnant with my first child, and I had studied art at college, and had always drawn and would do the occasional portrait painting, commissioned portrait painting. But then we are just surrounded by so much nature here, and all the birds just come and flock to our deck, and we feed them out of our hands. And so it was a logical step to start painting them. I was sort of seeing more animals than I was people. And then I sort of found my niche and my style, which was to do a different animal and a different brightly colored background, and then turn them into cards and prints, and then printed on fabric and made bags and aprons and tea towels. And it's really gone from there. 10 minutes before we recorded this, I got a knock on the door from a couple from the Netherlands who had found me through a local shop and given me a ring to say that they can't buy online because they're on the road, but can they come and get some more stuff? So just met a lovely couple from the Netherlands, and
Amazing.
yeah, I've heard that my stuff is all around the world now, which is great, and also hilarious because I'm not so sure that many countries know what an echidna is. But anyway, they're snapping them up. And
Oh, they love the
I
echidnas. I'm fond of the one you've got of the kangaroo
do.
and the kookaburra.
Okay.
But I really loved, and if people should, I'm re recommending everyone check out lucyhawkinsart.com. On your portrait tab, one comes up, and I think it's maybe one of your little people that
Yeah.
is the portrait. I love one, just the colors and the,
Thank you. Yes.
yeah, so that was beautiful.
Single window on that one, I think. Yeah, I love painting people. It gets a little bit tricky with portraits because you're trying to get the likeness, you're also trying to be flattering but also getting your style across. And mine is very bold, big brush strokes and lots of colours, quite distinctive. So I love it, but it's also agony painting because there's no cut and paste, there's no delete, there's you don't, especially with portraits, if you do one brush stroke and then oh you've just lost the lightness, it's just gone and you've really got to work to get it back. So there's no painting without pain, as some art teacher told me, and they were on the money. Whereas
So true.
I find the writing process a lot more relaxing or cathartic because you can just go over and over and fine-tune it and move things around, and there isn't so much of that with the painting. But I recently did an art class at my daughter's kindergarten, and I said, all right, so guys, we're going to paint some platypus. And to see them just slap the paint on with absolutely no regard for lightness, just out of the sheer creativity and joy of it, it taught me a really valuable lesson that that's what it should be about. Like, just stop trying to control the end result and just get, yeah, they had paint everywhere, up their noses. Like, it was just,
They're just loving
yeah, but they loved it.
the experience.
Exactly.
Now, the cover of your book, you collaborated with another artist.
Yes.
How much input did you have to your front cover?
So the publisher came up with a few ideas, and I didn't, I suppose because it was so deeply personal to me based on my two daughters. I had such a set idea of what I thought it should look like. And so I said, and I'm an artist, and my friends rightfully pointed out, will you do it then? I mean, shouldn't you be doing it? And I thought, yes, I probably should. So I had the idea that I wanted the two girls on this galleon ship, the Salvager, flying through space on this mission. But because I predominantly work in oil and acrylic, mine's really big, bold colors, and I wanted something more whimsical, watercolor, sort of light, fairy. I wanted to be able to really get the majesty of space. And so I found Claire, who's a local watercolor artist. Well, she does everything, she's amazing. And so I drew the girls too, which was also difficult because they were at the time, I think, 1 and 4, and they were supposed to be 9 and 12, but a general likeness of their faces on bodies in this ship. And then Claire did the rest. And neither of us are particularly technologically minded. And so it was just a case of literally cutting and pasting. And what if we put that there and then try that color there? So it was a real collaboration, and we're currently working on the second and the third book covers now, which is fantastic.
Sounds very exciting.
Yeah.
And did you have any trouble letting go as an
No.
illustrator yourself, or was it an easy process for you?
Very. I couldn't get rid of it quick enough. I felt so relieved that I had found somebody that shared a vision that was so talented, far more than me, and that it was in such good hands. No, it was wonderful. I wanted to give her my children, all my responsibilities. It was
And would you consider illustrating books as part of your creative business, or
I
do you
would.
prefer the canvas stuff?
No, I do still love drawing people and sketching. Sketching is probably my first love, and so yeah, I'm a doodler. I'm always drawing, and my daughter and I make our own little cartoon sheets, and that's absolutely something that I am happy to do. I just wasn't a good enough watercolor artist, and but when you're doing a big expanse of color like the deep blacks and purples of space, if you put paint on the canvas, then it spreads, it leaks. And unless you're very quick about it, then you're going to get that border mark. And I just didn't know how to spread it out. And, you know, that's something that you only can really grasp from doing it for years and years, which is what Claire has finessed. And so I just thought, you know, work to your skills. And I'm really happy with the writing. I'm really happy with the book. And I thought, if I can delegate, then I will.
Exciting. So there's two more books coming.
Yes.
But they're in the process of writing.
Yeah, second one.
At the moment.
So the girls are, I won't give too much away, but they're in the Himalayas. And I think it'll be a series of six, culminating when the girls are teenagers. And then they will need to make their decision, because the rule of the books, and the first one, is that the Council of Children that rule Planet Beatrice, when you turn 17, you've got to step down. So presumably when the girls hit that age, they will then have to decide, do they want to live full time on Planet Beatrice and say goodbye to Earth, or do will they want to stay on Earth and invest in its future? And I'm really keen to give the readers hope, because to the best of my knowledge, Planet Beatrice doesn't exist. And so we do need to still have hope for Earth. But by learning what happened to the woolly mammoth and the dodo, hopefully we can learn from our mistakes in time to stop the same demise happening to endangered animals and to the environment that they need on Earth to thrive now.
So it sounds like there's been quite a bit of world building involved in creating the Salvagers Quest. How much of that came about as you were typing, or was there a bit of thinking or planning involved with that world building?
The first one, it literally, the story told itself as I was writing. There wasn't much of a plan. It just came from a point of deep concern for the planet with COVID and with the bushfires, and my husband not having to drive into the city for work because of lockdowns. And even though I just had a newborn in between sleeps, and you know, that whole child rearing experience in a pandemic, it was just an ability to actually type, even if it was in between feeds in the wee hours. And so it unfolded there. But for the second and the third and going forward, yes, there's a bit of a more of a structure to it. Just to make sure that the messages that I have of hope and action, that I get those across, because I feel the responsibility of saying the right thing, of getting the balance right between, look, we do have to do something. Time is of the essence, but we can still pull it around. And I think that balance is quite important. You don't want to swing into complacency or panic. So, yes, there's more structure in these ones. There was joy in writing the first one, of just seeing, it was a shock to me how Planet Beatrice was going to take shape. And that's fun. It was really fun to write and hopefully to read.
I think that's the best thing about when you're writing something, when it's a story that needs to be told,
yeah,
and it's just got to come out of you. There is that feeling of joy in writing. There's plenty of pain in writing as well,
yes.
but there is times when I find if I've sat down and written something, like, you get that feeling of, oh, that was good.
Yeah.
That process was enjoyable to write that. And I think it's actually a good piece. Yeah. Although I haven't written a long form, like my expertise at the moment is short stories, right, and picture books.
Sure.
So I may be
an illustrator as well.
No, I'm not an illustrator, so I'm a bit of a stick figure.
Right.
my mum is an artist. She does some beautiful, she does watercolour, a bit of oils, and also ink. And she went through a stage where she was painting old spades and cream cans and all, yeah, that. She was that era.
Brilliant.
When I'm not sure if you would have been in Australia then, when there was a whole resurgence of old items getting painted, like you would do a black base and then do a scene on it.
I don't have presence. I've seen some Australian artists painting the lovely weatherboard houses, and my mum's Australian, fifth generation Australian. So I've always been out here every year to see my grandparents and aunties and uncles. And I love all of that Australiana. Yeah. Okay. Yes. So short stories.
Yeah. So mine, nothing really over 500 words. So.
But that, I mean, that's a skill, isn't it? To sum it up, to get.
Yes.
To get that whole storyline so succinctly. Well done.
But I'm living in that world of, I'd love to write this, but I'm a bit frightened. And I really, I just have to rip the Band-Aid off and sit down and do it. Yeah. So I do feel, though, because I was talking for years about, I want to be a writer. And I feel like I've shifted forward and I'm like, okay, I am writing things. I have got some publishing credits. I do have one book published. So I can say I'm a writer, but yeah, I do want to move forward and create some bigger bodies of work.
Yeah, you are a writer. Yeah, I still cringe when people ask what I do. I don't know if I cringe more at saying writer or artist. Either way, I just sort of want to dive underneath the desk. But I think that might be a theme.
You can say writer/artist.
Yeah, maybe, but it all seems so, what, so self-indulgent or... But isn't that a female trait that we don't really back ourselves?
Yeah, we have to do that more. And just overcoming that imposter syndrome. Is not necessarily just women feel that, but I think we are less likely to jump in feet first.
Yeah, but we must.
And risk things.
Absolutely. I'm ridiculously impulsive. I've never been fearful of anything, but the detrimental, the negative side of that is I haven't always thought things through. So that can have repercussions, but I think you've got to jump in and I think you've got to believe yourself, because time whips by and before you know it, and what's the worst that can happen? It doesn't get published.
That's it. Yeah. So I have some quick questions to ask you.
Great.
Just so our listeners can get to know you a bit better. So they're just a bit of fun. So what was your favourite book growing up?
Well, I think that I may have had some learning disability growing up, because I found school a real struggle. Concentrating was very difficult. And I remember picking up a Reader's Digest at home and had never really seen the joy of reading before, but then was lost into it. But they would have been short stories, but I couldn't tell you what. But it was the Terry Pratchett books that I remember being, that these were just incredible. This was making me laugh, and it was this whole different world and escapism. It was... it was a whole new world to me. So I'd say the Terry Pratchett books, the Discworld series.
They're so quirky and engaging and imaginative. Yeah, they're really a great book for kids who maybe are not loving reading.
Yes.
To discover that, there's a benefit of reading, is that I get to enjoy this whole world that somebody has created.
Exactly. Because the books that we were made to read at school, the Shakespeare's and things, which didn't feel at all relevant to me, it felt like a chore. And so to read something that was are they being a bit cheeky? Are they being silly? Is there a joke in here, like a subtle joke? Is that possible? Are grown-ups allowed to write something that's tongue-in-cheek? It was just fantastic.
I felt that way a bit with the Roald Dahl books, yes. Although... there is a bit of a mixed reception to them these days.
Okay. But, well, I just read them all to my daughter, and I know exactly what you mean. It seems to be physical characteristics go hand in hand with certain personality types, of which I'm just sort of skipping over because that's obviously nonsense. But there's a lot of great humour as well. The BFG I thought was brilliant.
Okay, so if you could be any book character, who would it be?
I think Phileas Fogg, because that whole era, 1872, and it was a time of new innovation and global travel, and that just always appealed the idea of being able to take off in all these fantastic machines, be it trains or ocean liners or hot air balloons. And there was something really romantic about that era and the dress, the costume, and arriving into Hong Kong, with those the boats with the sails, and you could feel the heat, the humidity, you could smell the spices. It was just such a romantic era. I mean, so much more than now. I hate flying. I've traveled quite a bit, but I hate it, the whole process of it. I don't understand how it's up in the air. And I don't want to be crammed in, not everything about it. It's such a wing clipping experience. But the freedom of travel back then would have just been glorious. So I'll go Phileas Fogg.
But much slower.
Yeah.
Although I find when I'm flying, if I just have to sort of disconnect from reality for a little bit. So if I start to think about how are we actually up in the air, and especially when with traveling with my sons, because they'll suddenly go, "Do we know where this pilot studies? What credentials has he got?" And I'm like, no, we're not thinking about any of those things, because if you start to think about all of the things in the world, at that level, you'll just go mad. So you have to switch off a little bit and accept that it is a miracle that we can fly and not analyze it.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's yes, I know that intellectually, I know that, but at the time, and also I was like, oh, I'm gonna have a little break. I'm not gonna drink alcohol for a month, and it just continued because I felt so good. So it's nearly 2 years of no booze. But I mean, getting on an aeroplane without that tiny little bottle of red was one thing that got me through, and now I don't have it. The stark reality of the metal in the air is even more frightening.
Is there something that you're reading right now? What have you got anything on your bedside table?
Yep, I'm reading Pax, which is Peace in the Age of the Roman Empire, and it's
Oh, okay.
yeah,
Sounds good.
Tom Holland, not the superhero actor, but the historian. Yeah, I got really fascinated in the whole origins. Well, of Christianity, really, that interested me, and then I sort of had to take it back to the classics of Greece and then ancient Rome, and I'm sort of now putting things into place. And I find that the topic of empire and colonization really interesting and really relevant to now. And yeah, so I'm embroiled with the Caesars at the moment.
Sounds interesting. I love a good historical book, so either a novel or
Yeah, me too.
I love facts as well.
Yes.
And my podcast list used to be all true crime, and gradually historical BBC podcasts are starting to push out all the true crime.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of like, oh, I love to learn, and I love to just, I guess it's learning about the human condition, that when you're studying people of power in the world,
Yeah.
or the people who didn't have any power but existed, they were royalty or just existed because they were
Yeah,
married to someone else. And
absolutely.
it's like,
Strategic
ah,
strategy
that's interesting.
it is. It's really fascinating. Yeah, and I found this podcast called The Rest is History, and so I just have it. We have an Airbnb, and I'm doing my painting, so I just have them chatting away in the background all day long. Yeah, but I've got to that age and stage where I just want to learn. Yeah.
Yeah, and I love a lot of historical fiction, so Alison Weir and Philippa Gregory and all of those, but because I love to, like, we all have challenges in our life, and I love to see how people who had real, like, my life is not at risk any day
Yes.
of the week, and I'm like, okay, I'd like to kind of put things in perspective and go, okay, this person was faced with this challenge, and this is how they endured it. And it's like for a period of time, like our life is so immediate, usually a problem doesn't last very long, and you can sort of go, well, in 5 years' time, what will today matter? But there were people that were enduring years, decades
I know.
of.
It gives me such perspective, but then it also gives me, and I'm not too worried about it, but it also gives me a real sense of just how short our lives are and how really insignificant we are in the grand scheme of things. And that doesn't necessarily bother me, but I'm sure the likes of some politicians, the only that their mortality is of such importance to them that the only way they can override their lifespan is to live on as a name, and that's why they're making these massive decisions, just as Julius Caesar or Alexander the Great made in history, because their ego is running the show. And I think that these guys, predominantly their egos, are sort of influencing the course of the planet. So that's a concern. But yeah, but what tiny lives we have, so we must jump in and grab it.
Yes, that's so true. Okay, so if you were having a dinner party and you could invite five literary people to dinner, who would you invite?
Well, I was always going to say Virginia Woolf because I love her writing, but then I read recently that she was a bit of a snob. I don't know about that. I don't know anymore. I think she'd still be good value. Anyone that can make me laugh is invited, I think. Stephen Fry, because of his interest in Greek mythology. He seems like a nice guy. Then I was going to go Nelson Mandela, because obviously that's an important story and relevant very much to now. I think he would be wonderful company.
And even after all that time alone and locked
No, I
away,
know.
to still be so engaging and
Yes, extraordinary.
having, like, you just get that vibe of a lust for
Yeah,
life when
absolutely.
you see him. When you see clips of him on television and things, it's like, oh, he's gone through all of that and yet
Not bitter.
still has passion and he wanted to change the
I
world.
know. Amazing. I mean, really, we really can all learn from him. You don't meet many people like that, do you? And yeah, so Nelson. Then I was going to go Holly Whitaker, because she wrote this great book that influenced. I think I'll have a look at the alcohol culture that we live in at the moment, from a distance, and see and just examine it. And that has been of major interest. And now I see so much on my Instagram feed of it's mummies drink time, or that how we're marketed alcohol, and how if every event that you go to, be it a painting class or at the cinema, there's always the add-on of alcohol, like that's the incentive. And I think that there are situations, scenarios like going for a lovely dinner or catching up with friends over a glass of wine that you can't replicate with a zero alternative. I think so. But I also think for the most part, we don't need it. We're being sold it. We should question who stands to gain from this, who's selling it to us. Do they really care about us? No. And it's not very good for you. So moderation there. And Holly Whitaker really summed it up nicely in her book. So I'd get her along. I think she'd be fun company. And then the last one I'd go for was Ernest Hemingway, because so my husband and I do quizzes, and he, I think, may have read three books in his life. He's not much of a book lover, bless him. And so whenever there's a literary question in the quiz, he will always say Hemingway. That's his go-to. So
We go to trivia every Tuesday night, and my husband's go-to answer is Marie
right.
Curie because he
I also
had
have curious.
a wonderful guest that helped us across the line when they had a portrait of her, and they were like, "Who is this?" And he went, "I don't know, Marie Curie," and it was right. So it's
Yay.
a bit of our in-joke as well that that's the go-to.
Marie Curie, to my mind, has invented penicillin, radioactivity is. I really, she's my go-to as well for anything of a medicinal scientific question. But for my husband, for literary questions, it's Ernest Hemingway. His repertoire is huge. He's written everything from Hamlet to Green Eggs and Ham, according to my husband. But I think Hemingway would be an interesting guy also. Sure, I would agree with all of his opinions, but I think he would have some incredible stories to share. Big character.
Well, yeah, I'm actually halfway through a documentary. I've got it saved on my Foxtel Fox box, where they were sort of saying that maybe some of his personality was and stories were a little bit self-promoted, so some of it, but I've got to make some time to watch the rest and see what their thoughts are.
Interesting guy.
Yeah, so some of his stories might have just been to keep his writing career going,
right?
But I'm not sure how much evidence there is in that doco yet. That's what I'm always saying to my sons: is check your sources and when you're sharing facts. So even with the rainforest stuff my son was sharing, I'm like, where did you get that information from? Make sure it's right.
Absolutely. Like, question.
Don't panic yet, but yes, it does. Yeah, it is a big thing. We are heading towards the loss of our trees, so I'm always like, please check your facts first.
I know, I'm a bit of a
the problem with Google and the internet is that which information is really correct and which is not, so you really have to make sure you use reputable sources.
Absolutely. Well, I've always been raised to do that. My dad's a journalist, and I wouldn't say a conspiracy theorist, but he certainly doesn't believe anything he's told, and so I'm sure a certain amount of that has rubbed off on me. But actually, no, what am I talking about? I'm so naive. I believe everything I'm told.
Okay, so what advice would you give yourself if you could go back to the beginning of your writing journey?
I think that would go back to when we were talking about mapping out your storyline, because although it was wonderful to just write the first one and to sort of make it up as I went along, I hadn't studied the structure of a book and how the ebbs and the flows and keeping the pace building. I hadn't studied any of that. So when I first sent it to an editor, they said that they loved the concept, but it just needed to be completely reworked. And so then essentially it had to be rewritten because you can't reference something that hasn't popped up before. So it was just moving things around. So it became a much longer process than writing the second one, which was just, I had it mapped out. I had a chapter plan. I knew how to build on it. I knew where it was going. And that was considerably easier. So, but then I don't know, like with anything really, you don't learn unless you make a mistake, do you? So
that's right.
I had to do it that way probably. Yeah. Everything has brought us to this spot, don't they say?
Yes, so, I say that to my husband all the time because we've only been married 3 years.
Right.
So we say, oh, we wish we had met each other earlier. And I'm like, well, everything that has happened to us has brought us to here now.
Really?
So we can't think like that. We just have to go, thank you for our past because it's given us our current existence. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I, for one, am really glad that I didn't meet my husband until later on in life because I just had stuff to do, had places to go and adventures to have, and I didn't want anyone slowing me down.
I am a bit of everything happens for a reason, but I think it's also a little bit of mental gymnastics to accept sometimes when things in the past haven't quite gone to plan. You can go, well, that just was, it is what it is. It's happened for a reason.
Yeah.
I'm here now because of that.
I'm battling with whether things happen for a reason. I'd love to believe that it's preordained or something, that there's a higher course. But then I also think, God, there have been so many millions of us. It can't all be a higher power plan. I think it just happened, to be honest. And And it's up to us.
Some of us have to be the minions.
Yeah, but yeah. And it's up to us to determine our course, really. So I'd love to believe that it's all going in the right direction, but similarly, I think it could all go horribly wrong. And so we've got to grasp every moment and make it happen for ourselves and contact people who might be able to help you. And if you never hear from them, well, that's fine, but do all you can, because it falls to you at the end of the day. You've got to be your biggest cheerleader.
Well, thank you so much, Lucy. We've had a great chat. We've gone in some interesting directions, which is amazing.
I love that.
I'm really happy to share this interview with my listeners, and I look forward to the next editions. So do you have titles yet for
yes,
what's coming after Salvager's Quest?
Yeah, the second one is the Salvager's Quest and the Ghost of the Mountains, which is a name that the Nepalese people give to the snow leopard in the Himalayas. So, yes, the girls will be up Everest for the second one.
Amazing. Mm. Sounds so exciting. Thank you so much for being with us today, Lucy.
Thank you very much.
Totally Lit is an independent podcast. You can help support us to continue to chat with wonderful Australian creatives by leaving a review on iTunes or sharing our socials with your friends. You can also make a contribution at www.buymeacoffee.com/totallylit. This will also help with equipment and podcasting platform fees. I love to interact with our listeners, so feel free to say hello either by email or social media, totallylitpodcast@gmail.com, or you can find me on Facebook, Insta, LinkedIn, and Twitter. We also have our Facebook group called Totally Lit Writing Community. It's a space to continue the conversation and share your writing successes, events, launches, and latest projects. Jump into the group and say hello. Thank you for listening to Totally Lit, and don't forget to go out into the world to read, write, create, ignite.